Welcome to the Successfully Unemployed Show. My name is Dustin Heiner, and I'm here to help you learn how to quit that J-O-B, that just over broke job, by any means possible. It could be freelancing, starting a business, side hustles, investing, whatever it might be. And today, I'm bringing on a fantastic real estate investor who's going to show us how we can do what he does in real estate investing to never work a job again. All right, let's start the show.
Welcome to the Successfully Unemployed Show, the place where ordinary people become extraordinary by finding the path to financial freedom through entrepreneurship, side hustles, and passive income. We've already blazed the path, showing you how to retire early and have financial independence so you will never work for someone else again. And now, here's your host, Dustin Heiner.
Hey, what's up, guys? You know what I really hate? I mean, there's a few things that I really, really hate, but I really hate this one thing. And this one thing happens literally once a year. In fact, no, I take that back. It happens all the time. It literally happens when, even when you die, it happens. Even when you spend money, it happens. Even when you make money, it happens. I absolutely hate taxes. And just now I finished up my taxes. In fact, well, I don't do my own taxes. I just have to fill out a sheet and my accountant does all the work. So accountants and property managers, those are the two people that I definitely don't mind paying because they make my life so much better. In fact, there's only two reasons why I ever hire somebody: that they make my life easier or they make me money. And both my accountants and property managers do make my life easier, and my property manager makes me money. Now, getting back to the taxes, when you think about it, we pay taxes on literally everything from federal income taxes, where you make money and you're penalized for working. You pay taxes on that, state taxes on top of that. Then sales tax, like when you make money, you get taxed. When you spend money, you get taxed. Even when you die, you get taxed as well. It's a death tax they have that basically everything goes on to your kids. It gets taxed again. If you get a dog, you have to license the dog. That's another tax. If you want to go fishing, that's a license. That's another tax. Just to own a car, there's a registration. That's a tax as well. There's property taxes that you have. There are so many taxes that if you add it up, more than likely, you are going to be spending 50% of all the money that you make, like especially if you have a job. If you're working that J-O-B, working for somebody else, that is the highest taxed person ever. Like you are basically paying a lot of taxes. Now, there are, you know, some people say, okay, the 1%, they don't pay their fair share. Well, honestly, if you really look at the numbers, the 1%, you know, like basically the wealthiest 1%, in total dollars, they pay like literally 90% of all taxes, total tax dollars, and then the balance comes up from us. But all of us normal people, we don't have billions of dollars that we're okay with just, you know, spending. And so when it comes down to percentage-wise, we pay a lot of money percentage-wise if you have a lot less, especially if you're working a job. If you're working that W-2, more than likely, 50% of your income is going to go to taxes. Everything I just talked about, from, you know, sales tax to income tax, property tax, getting a dog, registration, all that sort of stuff. But if you think about that, you have to work half of the year before you get any money to spend on yourself. It's absolutely irritatingly horrible. Now, what I love about real estate investing is I get so many tax breaks and tax benefits. Now, I'm not cheating the system. I'm not doing anything that's not literally written on the laws. The laws are written for us investors to make money and save money and be able to pass it down in generational wealth. And so that's what's amazing about real estate investing. On top of the passive income, on top of having other people pay off your mortgage, pay your taxes, pay your insurance, and all that sort of stuff, your tenants are basically doing that. But what it comes down to, you also get huge tax benefits. If you've never experienced the benefit of depreciation on your taxes, just wait until you get your first property and your accountant adds in depreciation. You're gonna be like, oh my goodness, how many more properties can I get because I save so much money in taxes? And now let's jump into today's show, where I interview Mike Simmons, a professional expert real estate investor, who's gonna show us how we can do it too. All right, here we go.
Tell us a little about yourself, Mike.
I was in the automotive industry for a number of years. I actually, when I was in high school, you know, I always tell people the playbook that was given to me as a young adult of what life, what you should aspire to do and be and how you should conduct yourself was written by, and nothing wrong with it, but by blue collar, union, factory working, good, hardworking people, right? But to them, the ultimate goal was to get into a company that has a union, right? So you're safe and you have benefits, work there for 30, 35 years, take all the overtime that they will give you, beg and plead for that overtime, work it all, grind yourself to a nub. This wasn't part of the pitch, but grind yourself to a nub until you're in your early to mid 60s. And then you retire and hope you can have enough money scraped together to sort of get by. Like that was kind of it, right? It was loving and it was, they were trying to do what's best for me, my parents. But that was my playbook. There wasn't anybody like, with the Hubble telescope, I couldn't have seen anyone in my sphere that was an entrepreneur that had anything to do with running businesses or was advising me on anything else, right? So right out of high school, I got a job at UPS. Great company, great benefits. It's the Teamsters. My dad could not have been more ecstatic that the Teamsters, like he's like, I wanted you to get in the UAW, but the Teamsters are even better, right? And so I thought, I'm going to be here the rest of my life. And I didn't go to college. And by the time I was 24, I had screwed my back up so badly from lifting boxes and things that I had to go to a chiropractor 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, just to get out of bed in the morning. Like I literally couldn't get up without going to a chiropractor. So I realized I wasn't dumb enough to realize that I could do that. I couldn't do that the rest of my life. So looked into the automotive industry, got a job in the automotive industry. It was a desk job. It was an inside sales kind of a job. And I, once again, I thought, this is it. This is where I'm going to be for the rest of my life. I love this company. And, you know, things happen. And back when in 2000 or right after 2000, when tech crashed, so did the automotive industry, went completely in the garbage and people were losing jobs left and right. And luckily, I didn't lose my job, but I was self-aware enough. And by the way, being raised by a Marine, if nothing else, makes you very self-aware and very, very capable of criticizing and looking critically at yourself. And so I realized I was a commodity. I wasn't anything special. I didn't have an education. I had very little experience. I was young. Like, I wouldn't even hire me if I were to be in the position to hire. So, right. So if I wouldn't even hire me, I've got to do something. Went back to school, got my degree as an adult with kids and a mortgage and all that. Got my degree. Great. Doubled my income. As soon as I got my degree, I switched companies, doubled my income. And I thought, again, third time in my life, this is where I'll be the rest of my life. Until I got into it and realized after a few years, the automotive industry, while wonderful and gives us great cars and people love it, and I get it, it's for a lot of people, it was killing me. It was eating my soul from the inside out, and I was miserable. And so I started, like a lot of us do in my early 30s, looking for an escape hatch. Like I was like, how do I get out of here? I have kids, I have a mortgage, I can't just quit, I'm responsible. I still have, you know, my upbringing in my head, you know, you need security, you need stability, like it's fine, I get it. But I have to figure out a way to take what money I do have and multiply it, right? And somehow amplify that money. And I started looking at stocks in the stock market, and day trading was a big kind of a buzz, you know, buzz thing back then. The reality was I hate it. And I don't have patience for reading how to invest in stocks and looking over stocks. I hate it I hated it more than I hated going to work. So I was like, all right, this isn't for me, right? I would be looking up things about stocks and reading things. And next thing you know, I'm on ESPN.com and NFL.com and I'm reading sports stuff. And I'm like, obviously I hate this. But when you research investing and how to invest and how do I invest my money and how do I retire early, at some point real estate will come up, right? So I hit real estate and started reading about investors and how they invest and flipping and I fell in love. Like I loved it. I couldn't get enough. Like I was insatiable reading. And I'll be honest, like a lot of us do when we get started, reading success stories was like a drug kind of, you know what I mean? Like I was just like reading it going, oh my gosh. And just kind of imagining how that would be. And I got really into it. I started going to conferences and I started going to meetups locally. But here's what I did. And this is probably the most important thing I can say in this entire conversation that we're going to have. I decided in 2003, I wanted to be a real estate investor. I put my stake in the ground and said, this is me. This is what I want. I am committed to this. Didn't buy my first house until 2008, 5 years later. I procrastinated. I had analysis paralysis. I was thinking of all the things that could go wrong, not the things that could go right. I had a very limited mindset, a very scarcity mindset. Like I was just I was keeping myself insulated, but I was going to meetups. I was going to conferences. I was reading books. I was listening to things on the internet. And so sometimes when we're starting off, we can fool ourselves that we're in the game because we're kind of immersed in it, but we're not making offers. We're not getting deals, right? And it wasn't until, and I swear, I hope everyone isn't this way, but for me, and I think a lot of people are, I'm more motivated by pain than pleasure, unfortunately. And so the analogy that I like to give is,
and hey guys, get my real estate investing course absolutely for free. Text the word rental, R-E-N-T-A-L to 33777. Rental to 33777, and I'll literally give you my real estate investing course showing you how to find an area of the country to invest, how to build the business first, how to scale the business, buy the right properties, making $250 or more every single month in passive income. I'll literally just give it to you. You can get started investing right away. Text the word rental to 33777.
I think most people will run faster away from a bear that's chasing them than they will toward a pot of gold. And I know a lot of people may say intuitive, oh no, I wouldn't. I would love to get a pot of gold. Trust me, you're going to run faster when you feel like you're going to be eaten and mauled to death. And I needed to get to the point in my brain where, like, the stock, reading about stocks was more painful than going to work. I needed to get to a point in my brain where I was more disgusted with my procrastination and fear than, you know, going to work wasn't better than the way I felt about myself every day when I woke up. And that's when I made my first, you know, couple of offers and got my first deal.
That is terrific, because I completely agree in that basically the entire thought process of, we start getting too much in our heads and we get the analysis paralysis. We even just start overthinking things and don't start doing, you know, it'd be like practicing your entire life for a sport and never actually playing a game. Well, you're not necessarily an actual, you know, athlete, you know, so you got to actually do it. And so what got you over that hurdle to actually do it? Was it something like a book you read? Was it all, you know, hey, this just happened to work out. This is a good deal. Let me put an offer. What got you over that hurdle?
Neither. It was a little more organic and a little more slow building. It was kind of like a pot of water you put on the stove and turn it on high, right? That cold pot of water was me in 2003. And the bubbling pot where the water's bubbling over, that was me in 2008. It got to a point where, again, I referenced that I was raised by a Marine, right? Jokingly said, you always are aware of your faults when you're raised by a Marine. So also in my family growing up, for better or for worse, right? This is maybe isn't the way it happens nowadays, and maybe it's not supposed to happen this way, but fear wasn't tolerated. Like, if you were afraid, you acted like you weren't, because if my dad knew you were afraid, you were going to do the thing you were afraid of inevitably. And so I was raised that way. I was raised to be a little intolerant of fear. Okay. All boys in my family, raised by a Marine. It was a very testosterone heavy family. And I just got to a point where and here's the key too. In 2003, I didn't tell all my friends and family I want to be a real estate investor. I didn't post it online. I didn't make myself accountable. I kept it all up here. I kept it in my head. And so by 2008, I was rotting from the inside because of my fear and doubt and procrastination. I just started feeling bad about myself. And it was like this slow boil till I got to a point where I was like, I can't live with this fear, this uncertainty, this putting off. I can't keep talking about how I hate my job, but then on the other hand, not doing anything about it. Like, all the things that I sort of rail on people now for, because I get it. I'm not a hypocrite. I'm just not sympathetic of that. I'm empathetic. I get it. I get where they're feeling that. I can totally understand, but I don't sympathize because I don't want to be an enabler of people making excuses not to change things. If you're not happy with something in your life, your weight, the way you look, your job, your money, your wife, your husband, your whatever, you need to do something about it and not just complain. And I got to the point where I was telling myself this, like, man, you are just afraid. You're being completely ridiculous. Like, you're miserable with yourself because you're not doing it. What's the worst thing that can happen? You do it and fail. At least you have clarity. At least you tried, right? And so I just got to the point where I couldn't live with myself. I couldn't get up and look in the mirror. I couldn't complain to my coworkers, to my wife, that I wasn't happy in my job. Like, I knew that I wasn't doing anything. And I was disgust. Like, I was disgusted with myself, honestly.
So was that first deal a flip? Was it a wholesale deal? Was it a rental property?
Yeah, it was a flip. At the time, that's all I really knew. I didn't even know what wholesaling was. I knew what rentals were, but I knew that I didn't want slow drip. I wanted influx of cash, right? I wanted bigger paydays. And unfortunately or fortunately, I was watching all these flip or flop kind of shows. I mean, back then they were different. Now you have Chip and Joanna and it's a feel good story and everything's beautiful and everyone gets along and no one yells. Back then there was a guy named Armando Montalongo or something,
yes,
right?
I remember him.
This guy we watched, like he was a hothead. He drove this obnoxious, like, you know, vehicle and he was just like, he just yelled at his car. Like everything was like stressed, right? But I was watching it to try to glean. And then I joined a local 3-day like workshop of a local guy who was sort of successful in real estate. So we did a flip. And back then it was 2008 going into 2009 when we bought the house. And I'm in Michigan. And Michigan in 2008, 2009, like,
oh man,
prices were down everywhere. But if you could imagine, like, if you're listening in some state where, you know, the median house price is $750,000, get ready. I'm going to blow your mind. I bought a house for $40,000. And it wasn't like a house in a war zone. This was a house in a nice, clean, blue collar neighborhood, 3-bedroom, 1,000-foot brick ranch with a basement and a two bathrooms. I mean, it was a nice little house. And we put $15,000 in renovations. And, you know, we learned a lot. And if you're interested, we can talk about lessons learned on that first one. But at the end of the day, we made $15,000 in profit once we sold it. And everything, you know, was accounted for. Net profit, $15,000. And my wife grew up poor. I grew up very middle class. Like, we didn't have tons and tons of money. I had never seen $15,000 at one time ever in my life. It was like winning the lottery. And my wife is super risk averse. And super careful with money. Okay. Put it that way. Super careful. But when she saw the proof and I saw the proof and we sort of understood the process, we were both like, go, 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 like all systems go. Right. And I just started making offers like a madman. And we kind of went from there.
I love that story. I love how you really got into it and figured out that, because if you started thinking, everybody would realize that the crash happened in 2008, 2009. So if you start picking up properties after the crash, so much better. I started investing in 2006 and so started buying properties for rental properties. And even though the value literally was cut in half on some of my properties, I was still making passive income. So I'm still fine. In fact, I still own them right now. But if you were flipping from 2005, 2006, and then I could see that. But I definitely, you got in at a better time and obviously successful now. Now tell me about this market now. We're knowing this is 2022 and it's definitely a seller's market, low inventory. If we were to buy a house now, is there anything that we should be looking for? Like lower priced homes? Like, are we using the 70% rule? Like, can you walk me through, if I want to flip a house now, what's the best way to get started?
So I will say this, okay? People ask me, and I'm sure they ask you all the time, who are not in real estate, how's the market, right? How's the market, okay? Here's the deal. Here's my little rant on the market. The market is always great. It's always great. It's great for somebody all the time, right? It's as investors, it's how we position ourselves. It's how we adjust and adapt to the market that determines whether or not we're successful. So the market is never your problem. It's always how you're reacting or how you're adjusting your business model to it, right? And so in a seller's market, yeah, inventory is a little lower. It's a little more competitive. People know they can sell for more. It gets a little more challenging on the buy side, but the sell side is fantastic, right? If you're flipping houses, like, you're back in the, when you reference like 2005, 2004, 2003, I used to go to these meetups, like I said, and one of the strategies that people taught openly, like with confidence and with a straight face, was buy a house for retail, sit on it for 2 years and sell it. Like, that was a strategy, right? We were banking on appreciation 100%. Those people obviously probably got burned at some point. But in this market today, I'm not saying you should do that, but you could almost do that. Or at the very least, you could buy it higher than you really would be comfortable 3 years ago and feel good that the prices are going to be there, right? I don't suggest that. But to answer your question a little more specifically, how would I go about it? Here's what I tell people who I coach and mentor all the time. Even in this market, my company, and I run an active real estate company, I'm not just talking theory. Like, we're doing this every day. We buy 100 properties a year. We've had higher profit years the last 2 years than we did pre-pandemic. And there's a number of reasons for that that are a little bit of a tangent, not directly into the question you asked. But the point is, we buy as investors, We don't buy from people whose houses are in top shape and they have nothing but time to sell it and there are no rush and there's no urgency and there's no motivation. They just want to sell maybe sometime. We never buy from those people. Those folks are going to be on the MLS for sure. But there are always people who have divorce, death, inheritance, job transfer, tax deferred, CapEx expenses that are just beyond what they can possibly deal with. There's always life situations that creates motivation that allows us to go in and buy properties at a deep discount while solving real problems for people. So when we go to the closing table, if you're listening to this as an outside and maybe not an investor, or you're very new, you might think, oh, wow, so you're taking advantage of people who are in a bad situation. Guess what? We get hugs. We get thank you letters. We get calls crying, thanking us and telling us that God sent us to them and we answered their prayers because their problem isn't getting another $10,000 for their house. Their problems are something else and we solve their problems. And as a result, we're able to buy their house at a price that makes sense for us, right? So it's a good thing. But people always have those life issues that allow us to buy. Now, are more people choosing to try their luck on the MLS who maybe before were kind of in that gray area where they're motivated, but not in a lot of pain right now. And so they have maybe 3 or 4 months that they could wait. Sure, they're going to the MLS right now first, and some of them are selling them just fine. But what happens when in this market is people go to the MLS because they have 3 or 4 months and they blow 3 months of that 3 or 4 months. And when they come back to us because they couldn't sell because the house was in shambles or there was some other issue going on, they're ultra motivated, right? And so we're able to find these deals. It's harder, I'm not gonna lie. It's harder than it was, but it's still doable. In this market, speed is everything. In a market like 2008, man, I could just take a gun and shoot fish in a barrel. It was so easy to get deals. Like it was really a matter of how many can I handle at once, right? Now it's not really like that, but speed kills, okay? It's a boxing term, right? Speed kills, but it also applies to business. If you can get in there, get your offer in, get that contract before your competitors, you'll do much, much better. I have a friend of mine who runs a really successful real estate investing company. And when I was new, he was sort of mentoring me and he said, a company like me, I'm successful, I make a lot of money, but the fact of the matter is I have more moving parts than you do. So when I receive a call, it goes to our call intake, then it goes to maybe a salesperson and they have to pre-qualify and then they call back and then we set an appointment. If you get a call, set an appointment and get there that afternoon, you will most likely beat us most of the time. So speed can compensate for maybe a very competitive market. You just have to be fast. I hear investors all the time tell me, oh yeah, I'm getting some leads and I got some calls. I haven't called back yet. They called me on Monday. It's Wednesday. I'm like, what? Or I saw this deal come through my, you know, across my desk and from a wholesaler and it looked like a really good deal, but I was busy. And so I was going to make the offer after work and it was already sold. I'm like, speed, man, speed. You have to be more aggressive.
Especially like you're right in this market right now where it's a seller's market. People who are investors or flippers or even wholesalers, like they get properties under contract very fast. Those are the ones that actually win. Those are the ones that actually do well is who move quick. Now, let me give you an example. So there's a property that at my church, I was talking with some people and an older lady said, oh, Dustin, you're an investor. My brother-in-law, like literally it just happened. My brother just passed away and I have his house. It has to go through probate. Would you be interested in buying it? I'm like, yeah, I'd be interested in buying it. And as I'm talking to her, she's wondering how much would she be able to get for it by selling it to a flipper? You know, I'm rental properties. I want to buy it long-term, hold on for passive income. And she was asking me, well, how much, if I were to sell it to somebody who would flip it, how much would I be able to sell it for? So let me run that by you. What are your thoughts? Because I know what I would buy it for a rental property, like how much I can afford, how much it's going to cost to fix up, all that sort of stuff. Now, let me give you the whole scenario. Let's say she thinks that she can sell it for right around $400,000, anywhere from $300,000 to $400,000. There was a house. Oh, this house sold for $400,000 because it was flipped and it's beautiful on the inside. Now she's looking, she owes $100,000. No, what I'm giving you, sorry, everybody listening, I'm giving you the insights into the conversations that we have as investors with sellers. And so the seller is saying, well, I have these needs because as an investor, if we don't listen to their needs and we just go after what we want, you're not going to get the deal. We want to, like you said, Mike, you hit the nail on the head. We help people people need to get out of certain things. Like maybe this lady that I'm working with, she's a super nice lady, but she doesn't want this drag on her. It's not great for her. She's not an investor. She doesn't want to do that stuff. She just wants to get out of it. So I'm there to help her. Now, here's the thing. She owes $90,000 on the house. It was a reverse mortgage for this property. The brother was taking the money out. Now there's $90,000 loan. And at the same time, she's saying Zillow is selling it for $240,000, or the value, Zillow's quote unquote value is $240,000. How would you proceed? She's saying, I think they could flip it and be $400,000. She owes 90, and you know, for to get rid of the loan, and Zillow's saying 240. So those are all the scenarios. How would you approach that?
I mean, there's a couple of things I want to know. Is 400 real? Like, do I know if that's real, or am I just taking her opinion on that?
There is one house that sold for right around $400,000 that was completely gutted. Completely.
Okay.
But this house is definitely one thing I didn't tell you, about $100,000 worth of work if you're going to flip it. It needs a lot of work.
Yeah. If I was going to flip it and she thought it was worth $240,000, to me, that, and again, it sounds like a weird question, but I have to ask, how old of a person are we talking about here? And how isolated is she from her family, or does she have support? Like, what's this question like?
Yes, those are fantastic questions. She's about, I want to say about 70, 73, probably.
Okay.
There's nobody else in her life. Her kids are moved away, and it's really just her. And she has had a rental property in the past. She moved out of one and rented it out. But she's like, yeah, I'm just done. I just want to get rid of it. I don't want to have to think about it anymore.
So I'm a little more careful in this case. And it's because I want to be a good person more than I want to be rich, right? So to me, though, I would ask her what she wants. What do you want? What would make you happy, right? And if she says 245, I don't know if that's what she would say. But to her, that's the high watermark, okay? We can, for a minute, if we believe 400, we can set that aside. 245 or whatever you said, 240 is the high watermark. I would ask her what she thinks is fair, okay? And let's just run a scenario. If she says, well, if I could just get what I owe, I'd be happy. I'm not saying she said that. But if she said that, I would not pay her what she owes. That's way too low, and that is a predatory kind of a way of looking at this. But let's just say I ran my numbers and my maximum allowable offer, let's just say, was 200, just for example, right? And if I said, what would make you happy? What do you think is fair? What do you want to get? And she said, if I could get, you know, 150, I would be happy because my house needs a lot of work. I would probably, in that case, give her more than 150, somewhere between my 200 or whatever I said and 150. We probably would end up in the 175 range because I want her to feel like she got what she wanted and more. But I still, you know, if every deal we walked into that was like a killer deal for us, if we just gave away all of our equity, like that's a little bit ridiculous too, right? I want her to feel like she wins. And especially if she's an old lady with no family, no support, no one who's going to run, she can run this by to check that she's okay with this. I'm going to err on the side of giving her even more than she wanted a little bit. So she feels real, real great about it and move on. And I think that would, I mean, just, we're talking very high level now, right? I haven't gotten into the details. Like, is there a foundation problem? Foundation can be wildly different in price, right? But in general, if my number said I could pay 200 and that's a good deal for me and she wanted 150, we'd probably end up somewhere in the middle. Now, this is just the way I operate. But if this was a 40-year-old man and he was fully aware and he had family and he knew, you know, all this stuff, and he said he wanted 150, we might try to get it for 130. Because in that case, I feel like I'm negotiating with someone who has the ability to completely make this decision. And we do try to get better deals than what even we think we can get if we can. But we routinely with older folks, and we deal with mostly with older folks, by the way. I don't deal with a lot of 40-year-old men. I deal with mostly 60 plus old people. But we've had people, and I'll tell you a short story to illustrate what I think what we need to do as investors more often. I hired a salesperson like month one. He was new. He didn't know anything about real estate. He was great at sales. And so I would figure out the maximum allowable offer. I'd give it to him before he went to the appointment. I would say, get it for this or less, right? And he would call me if he had questions like on the appointment, like, hey, I went in there and it's like the furnace is in a weird spot. Like, how do I even account for that? And so we would talk through it, right? But he was so good at sales, he could get great prices even with limited knowledge of real estate. And by the way, if you're hiring a salesperson, do not necessarily sort for real estate experience. It almost doesn't matter. But he called me one time and he said, hey, I'm in this house. It's an older lady, like really old. She has no family. Her husband's deceased. And she has no idea what this house is worth. Like she, it's free and clear. Like she only wants like $20,000. This thing's worth like 180. Like we could probably sell it for 200, right? She only wants $20,000. He goes, what do I do? And I said, you want to be able to look at yourself when you wake up in the morning.
You're asleep at night. So
figure out what our max offer is. Maybe drop it down a little bit and come to something that we sort of win and she really wins, because we were our max allowable offer on the house, I think it was like 75-80,000, right? She wanted 20 because she's like, I don't know, it's 20,000 too much kind of an attitude. And I said, dude, I understand your sales, you want to crush it, I get it. He was a super aggressive young sales guy, and I said, you have to not to get like religious, but let's just think about your eternal soul for a minute here. Is it, where are you going to trade that for 50 grand? Like, dude, it's just not worth it. And if you don't believe in that, just like, if you just don't want to feel like you're a piece of garbage, like don't take advantage of old people. Don't take advantage of anybody, but certainly not people who are incapable of really like understanding what you're doing. So with older folks, we sometimes pay a little more, honestly, if they're kind of like on their own and you know, we do a little differently. But, you know, if we're buying from someone who's like ready to negotiate with us and they're like close to the vest and they got this, and we'll negotiate kind of hard and we'll get houses a little cheaper than maybe even we thought we would get them. So I don't know. It's like a long, convoluted answer, but I just think it's important that we don't treat everyone exactly the same. If someone is vulnerable, we're way more cautious and we tread much more lightly and we think really, really hard about what we're doing and what we're offering, so that if ever this came back, we would feel very good about what we did and we would have no problem explaining ourselves, right? I mean, you should never take advantage of anybody. I'm just going to say that, but we're real careful with older folks.
I love that perspective too. And as I'm talking with her, I'm also trying to educate her as well, helping her to understand what she could get, not because I want the property. I would be great to have it. But if she is trying to sell it for more than I can afford, then hey, that's over my top dollar. Let me help you out. I'm a friend. You know, I want to help you. I want to see you be better off than when I met you. So I love that. Now, you mentioned running the numbers to make sure that you're going to be making money, because there are things that people don't like. When there's a flipping, you don't really, you watch a TV show that's, you know, flipping, you don't see like carrying costs. You don't see realtor fees. You don't see a lot of expenses. So if you're going to run numbers, how do you make sure that you're running it right? Maybe give us any somewhat specific examples of how we can run numbers right.
So I give this formula out when I give talks or presentations or whatever. So we don't use the 70% rule anymore. I think the 70% rule are training wheels and they're fine. I think you kind of need that when you're starting off so that you sort of stay safe. We don't use the 70% rule because it really works differently in different markets. It's a guideline, right? It's like you're throwing a dart. You're getting close, but you're not necessarily hitting the target. So we take a much more mathematical, like analytical approach, but I've seen people with spreadsheets with like 25 variables. We don't do that. I'm not that insane, right? And so I would have pulled it up if I know we're going to ask this question, but basically it's ARV minus purchase price, obviously, minus expenses, minus renovation, minus exactly what you said, taxes, insurance, cost of money. We throw in a little bit of a fudge factor, like a 5 to 10%. Oops, we kind of missed that thing because we don't do inspections. And so we sort of try to assume the worst. And we don't do inspections. You might think it's because of the market that we're in and we're trying to be competitive. We've never done inspections, right? I think if you assume that things are going to go a little sideways and you sort of build that into your price, you can be okay most of the time. We've never been burned when we followed our own rules. We've only been burned once, and it's because I broke every one of my rules and I deserve to get burned. It was an ego play and it was total mess. But that's what we do, right? Like purchase, renovation, all the holding costs that you talked about, and then a little bit of a fudge factor. And then our profit obviously has to be built in there too, right? So we reduce it by our profit. And then as a wholesaler, I've got to reduce it. So I have to take account the house flipper's profit and then my profit on top of it. So honestly, most of our purchases come in the 40 to 45%, you know, or 45, you know, cents on the dollar kind of a range. That's pretty much where we're buying most stuff.
You said 45 cents on the dollar?
Yeah, about that.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. So how do we know how much a house is going to sell for once we fix it up? Like, how do we know that? Is it just comps on something that, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was gonna say you better know that before you buy. But and the market can change, right? But as a house flipper, if you're really kind of on top of it and you're running a good business, you should have most deals. I mean, you should have most of them flipped in 90 days or less. Like if it's a real big renovation, it'd take 90 days. If not, 30 to 45 days. But the way that you do it, and I just had this conversation yesterday with someone that I'm coaching, and she said we were talking for a while, and she's like. And I said, you got to find the ARV. And the ARV, to answer your question, is preferably if you have access to the MLS, that's always the most concrete data, right? People use Zillow, Redfin, and all these other things. I use the MLS. But we're looking for houses. And this is also why you can't necessarily rely on a realtor to give you your ARV. Because as investors, ARV is our only houses that are renovated, that are in top condition. Those are what I use for my ARV. I can't mix in foreclosures or houses that were like super dated and outdated and had issues. You can only look at houses that are in your, at your quality level that you're going to attain once this thing is renovated. And then, you know, you want to stay in the same school district as the house that you're going to be flipping, because for a lot of people, the school district really matters and changes the price. You don't want to cross city boundaries, right? If you're on the edge of a city, you can't go into the next city to get your comps. I try to stay away from comps of houses that are like brand new built. If mine was built in the 70s but fully renovated, it's still different. I try not to buy on main roads. And so I try not to pull comps from main roads because, again, that'll hurt the comp a little bit. So I'm looking for houses that are the same relative square footage, give or take 15%, the same style if possible, in the same city, same school district, and at a top, you know, fully renovated. They look like they've been fully renovated. Those are what I use for comps. And you go out, depending on where you are, half a mile to a mile. I try not to go past a mile because I feel like it becomes a little irrelevant when you get past a mile.
Yeah, I would agree. And for everybody listening, if you don't know what those terms are, ARV is after repair value and comps are comparables. Basically, you're just trying to find the exact same type of property, everything as similar as possible as the property once you have yours fixed up to be. And see, that can say, hey, it probably sold, it could sell for this, which is great. Now, how much do you account for, wrong way to say it. How much profit do you try to find in every property or try to make in every property?
When I'm flipping here in Michigan, right, could be different states, we shoot for 20%, right? If the house gets up to a little bit of more, or if I'm going to buy a house that's going to eventually sell for $300,000-$500,000, sometimes we'll go down to like 17-16%, but we try to stay at that 20%. That's our kind of our watermark. If we go higher, great. If we go lower, we take a real close look at it. And here's a big mistake that I hear a lot of people make, right? So let's just say for easy math, we're $100,000 ARV. We want to make $20,000, right? The risk or the temptation, I should say, of a new investor is, well, shoot, I don't need to make $20,000. I'd be happy to make you $5,000. Like, that's a lot of money. And then so they build all their numbers with making $5,000. And then it takes longer to sell. Maybe the renovation budget goes way out of whack. You find a foundation issue. Next thing you know, you're the other way $5,000. So some of that money that you're building in for your profit, that $20,000 I'm talking about, you're doing it also because you realize things can go wrong that are unforeseen, and even the most experienced investors have things happen. And so you want to make sure that there's enough cushion. Yeah, 20,000 is optimal, but if something goes completely sideways and you make 10, okay, we made 10. We learned a lesson there, right? But if you plan on 5, boy, you are on the ragged edge. Anything goes wrong, you lose all your profit.
Help me to understand. It seems like you would figure out what you could, correct me if I'm wrong, you go to the end number of what you can sell the property for, let's just say $200,000, and then you subtract 20% of that, and that's $40,000. So you're down to 160, and then you figure out how much the repair costs, you know, rehab costs and your carrying costs, and you subtract that, and that's how you get to your number?
That's how I get to my number. Yeah, it's just math. It's just the situation, though, is two things will have a wild impact on what that final number is. The two biggest factors that will bite you in the butt are your ARV and your renovation costs, right? So what people tend to do, it's human nature, we inflate the ARV and we minimize the renovation so that we can create deals for ourselves. And then we end up being in a little bit of trouble at the end and we wonder why. It's because we're being overly optimistic in the beginning about the ARV and a little bit pie in the sky with our renovation costs. So those two numbers, if they're relatively accurate, I say this all the time, and I say it on my podcast because it's my podcast. I can do what I want. I don't want to mislead anybody or upset you. But if those two numbers are accurate and you stay very disciplined, it is very hard to lose money in real estate. Very hard. Unless the market corrects overnight like it did in like 08, 09, then okay, all bets are off. But in general, if you're very disciplined on those two numbers and you're reasonably accurate on the other ones, it's not... You can't lose money, but you almost can't lose money. It's very different. You have to really do something stupid. It's just not that risky when you're disciplined.
I completely agree. And same thing with rental properties. I tell my students, I tell everybody on my podcast and everything, it's like, it's very hard to lose money if you do it right. If you're doing it right, if you're accounting for your expenses, you're accounting for how much you could rent it out for. Same thing with flipping a property. Just like any business, property, real estate is literally just a product. And I like how you said, if you're going to hire a salesman, hire somebody who can sell. It doesn't matter that they know real estate or not. They're salesmen. It's a product. It's really what it comes down to. If you could sell that product and make a profit for it, then you're going to do well. It's just the nuances of learning the lingo. So I love the idea that as you were talking about, after we're going to be flipping a house, what we want to do is we want to make sure that we're accounting for all the expenses. But at the same time, it's really hard to lose money if you follow the steps. Is there any other steps or lessons that we should learn as we're thinking about becoming flipping and becoming an investor?
Yeah, it's kind of a little counterintuitive, especially considering the last 10 minutes of our conversation, but don't overthink it. You can't get so caught up in being paranoid that you're forgetting something and you're gonna lose money, because you can talk yourself out of every single deal out there. You can totally talk yourself out of it. And so I do think you have to be decisive. And there is a couple of things that we learned, and some of the, I don't know how like ticky-tack or how nuanced you want me to get, but I mentioned foundations. Foundations have burned us. We have totally minimized the situations with foundations to our detriment, because foundations, in my experience, they're a $3,000 to $30,000 problem, and you have to really think about that. Little things, I talked about my first deal. The first deal that I did, I didn't get all the subcontractors to sign a waiver saying that they had been paid, right? Like, I didn't get them to sign that waiver, all the subs. And so I paid my general contractor. He didn't pay his subs. And I had to go back and like negotiate with the electrician and the plumber. And I was blindsided. I didn't even know what was happening. Like, when I went to sell it, there was a lien, right? There were all these contractor liens. And I'm like, what? I don't understand. I paid for all of this. And I called these folks, and most of them were pretty cool. And they're like, I believe you that you paid your sub. I do believe you, but we didn't get paid. And so we have to get paid. And so I just start negotiating. And so getting those waivers signed was huge for us. I had a $20,000 sewer situation that I didn't foresee. I didn't scope the sewers when I was buying a house, and it cost me $20,000 at the end of the day. So little things like that you realize are like the couple hundred bucks you spend to check that stuff out is money well spent. And so, you know, I said we don't do inspections and we don't do full inspections, but we have sometimes very specific people come with us on the walkthrough and just 15 minutes check things out for us. I'll have a foundation guy. If I think there's any issues, I'll have a foundation guy come and just take a look and just ballpark it. Are we talking 30 grand? Or are we talking 3 grand? What's that? Or am I just seeing something that isn't a problem? It's just settling. It's been that way since 1950 and it hasn't changed in, you know, 50 years. Those are the kind of things that kind of burn you. I mean, there's a whole sales side of this that we could talk about. You alluded to it, but I think when you're starting off, man, there's so many impulses that you have that are wrong that you need to throttle. And one of them is to go in there and immediately you're negotiating. Immediately you're trying to beat them up on their price. I'm telling you, if you're talking about the purchase price before the very end of the meeting, and if you're not waiting till the last 15 minutes to get into it, you're screwing that up. Because to both of our points, we've said you're solving problems. You need to go in there. You need to be a listener. You need to have empathy. You need to understand their issue. You need to legitimately try to find the solution to their problems. You need to be someone who has the ability to care and legitimately try to help people. Because listen, we buy houses where we are not the highest bidder. We're not. But the sellers tell us, I'm not selling to anybody else but you. You're the only people I'm going to sell to, right? When you get a seller to say that, you've done your job. They know you, they trust you, they believe you, and you're being honest with it. Like, it's a great thing. And so we have investors come in and make higher offers, and the seller said, hey, I had somebody offer more than you, but don't even worry about it. I'm selling to you guys.
Yeah, it's because they know that you are looking out for them. You're trying to help them. And if, like you said, if you go into the deal already talking about numbers, without even seeing what they need, what the seller wants, how you can help them. I found the more people I help in this life, the better my life gets and the better other people's lives get, the more money I make. Just like we talked at the beginning of the show, talk about my Real Estate Wealth Builders Conference, the conference that I'm putting on. It's all about helping people. It's all about, because if you've been to any other real estate investing conference, it seems like a lot of them are like, hey, or at least the ones that you see on the infomercial at, you know, 2 a.m, hey, come, we're coming to your town. Usually it's like, hey, you know, run to the back and the first 20 people, we're going to discount it to only $20,000 to come work with us, something like that. And so with the Real Estate Wealth Builders Conference, it's like, it's just all of us awesome investors getting together and talking about how to invest in real estate, not looking to get anything. And we're getting people just so pumped about coming because we just want to help. And same thing with the seller, the lady that I'm working with right now, trying to help her with her property. It's like, how can I help you? What would you like to get out of this? And the biggest thing, like you said at the very beginning, was you're not taking advantage of people. Because a lot of people think, oh my goodness, you're buying it for so cheap, like half as much as it's worth. You know, you're taking advantage of it. Like, no, I'm not twisting their arm. Like, I'm not breaking their legs to sell the house to me. I'm seeing what they need. And I'm giving them an offer that I can afford for my business. And if it works for them, it's going to be great because I'm helping them out. So I think that's all fantastic. Is there anything else?
I will say this too. Let me say this too. It's important to note. We tell people regularly when we go to their house or we have this appointment with them, if we think they're significantly better off putting their house on the MLS, we will tell them and hook them up with a realtor. Like, we do not take down every house that we have an opportunity to, because some people just really should be on the MLS. They really should be, right? And so we do that. Another kind of, this is a little bit, you're asking about flippers, so I'm kind of focusing in that area right now. But another thing that we have learned, a little pro tip that's, people don't intuitively do this, or they don't think it's necessary, and then they get a little burned. Contractors will oftentimes shoot themselves in the foot, or they will go off the rails for no apparent reason, despite the fact that you're feeding them deals, you're paying them on time, you're treating them well. They have their own little situations that are going on in their life sometimes. So it's really, really important as a house flipper, because a contractor can really make or break your business, right? So it's important that you build a bench. You need to think of your company like a Major League Baseball team. You need to have a farm team that you're constantly developing, constantly talking to, creating relationships, having people on speed dial that you're ready to talk to when your drywaller goes AWOL or steals all the drywall and goes to a different job or whatever they do. You need to have somebody you can call who can jump in and get going. You've already talked to them, you've vetted them, you know their pricing, like they know you, they're ready to go. Like, you need to build that bench, because waiting for the next contractor to find them and advertise and bring them in, you don't know if they're good or not. Like, that can waste time, and time is money. Holding costs are real, especially when you're in a market, you know, where house prices are $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000. The cost of money, the holding costs, all that stuff will cripple you. So you need to have someone that you can call when and if, and really more of a when than an if, your contractors will fail at some point, right? So you need to have someone who can come in and pick the ball up and run.
I agree. Man, okay, so what other investing do you do? Obviously flipping, wholesaling, but is there any other type of investing that you do?
Flipping, wholesaling. I had rentals for a long time. I know that your jam. I actually just sold them off for a couple reasons. I made some mistakes with my rentals. I bought a lot of rentals in sub-desirable locations, and I did minimum renovations, not necessarily the cosmetic stuff to make it look nice, minimal, like major mechanical renovations that were probably too close to the end of their life to ignore. And so I had 25 properties that started having all these major mechanical issues, and I knew it was just going to be a tidal wave. It was going to end up happening long term. That combined with the market situation, right? Prices are really, really high. There's more, so much equity in these houses. And the final thing, which is probably the biggest reason, is I started doing a lot of lending. I started a full, like, legitimate hard money lending company. And so I was just sort of consolidating capital so I would have that to deploy. And I was really more focused on the lending than I was on my rental. So that's why I sold them. So flipping, wholesaling, my lending company, I just started a short-term rental company with my daughter, which is new. We haven't bought anything yet, but we're going to build that company up this year so that she can basically become financial free. We're just gonna split it, so it'll be nice for me. But I'm starting to do that, and that's really it. I mean, that's enough. It's more than enough. I probably have
really
got...
it. I mean, you're doing like four things that people wish they did one of those. And so
yeah, I mean, you. The only other thing that I'm doing is, and this is maybe tangent, but you know, I've been coaching people for a long time. I know you do too. You have your conference, and I've got a group of a mastermind that I'm an owner of, of that company. But I've never done any like on my own coaching people. It's always been in a mastermind situation, which is awesome. But I just developed a program that I'm launching next month that's designed to teach people not how to start, not how to buy their first property, but how to build and scale a business that they can remove themselves from. Because like I said, I'm doing 100 houses a year. We're doing over seven figures. I don't spend any time in that company. Like I'm there an hour a week, and half an hour of that hour is a weekly standing meeting that we have, right? And then the rest of it is like a half an hour the rest of the week where I maybe answer a question or something. So I want to teach people not how to go from 40 hours a week at a company to working 80 hours for yourself. It shouldn't be that way, right? We need to be able to build these companies and structure them and know how to hire and delegate and train and build a foundation and a structure around it that allows you to not be vital to every decision, and you can back out and you can scale your company without being a slave to it. So that's the program that I just built, and that's kind of where I'm focusing a lot of my time right now, actually.
I love that. And with Master Passive Income, one of my brands that I have, I love building businesses that are passive income businesses. And it doesn't have to be like, you know, you write a song and then that song continues to sell. That's passive income for sure. But if you create a business that has other people doing work and you're not working, you're blessing somebody else with a job, being able to provide for their family, as well as you're not doing the work, but you got to, there's a lot of work building up those systems and processes in place, getting the right people in place. So that's great. Now, Mike, how are people going to be able to find you, check out this new program that you're working on, and how can people find you online?
So a couple of things. So I have a podcast like this, similar. You were on it recently. It's called Just Start Real Estate. So if you go to wherever you listen to podcasts, go to Just Start Real Estate. You can find me and you can find Dustin on his episode. Additionally, my program is called Seven Figure Investor, and it's the word seven spelled out. So the word sevenfigureinvestor.com, you can go and check that out. Or if you want to go to just mikesimmons.com, you can find the program there and you can find out about the podcast and everything else I'm up to. So mikesimmons.com.
Well, thanks for coming on the show, Mike. It's been great. Awesome. And I know I've learned a ton, and everybody else has too.
Today's episode has been brought to you by the Real Estate Wealth Builders membership. That's the membership that I founded, teaching people how to quit their J-O-B by investing in real estate rental properties. Now, Real Estate Wealth Builders is your place to learn how to invest in real estate with five different masterclass courses, group coaching with me, and a private student community where we all work together, all the tools and the discounts, all the resources and everything that you need to quit your J-O-B by investing in real estate. Now, I do want to show you how to do this completely for free. If you want to learn about investing in real estate for free, I want to get you my free real estate investing course. Text the word rental to 33777. That's R-E-N-T-A-L. To 33777, so you can see how you can quit your job, that J-O-B, by investing in real estate. I'll show you how to find properties, how to use other people's money to buy properties, and how to scale the business to be successfully unemployed, just like I did. Now, did you also know that there are video versions of each and every single episode on the Successfully Unemployed show? Well, I did record every single one of these for you. I recorded them for you so you will be able to learn from the experts themselves, see what they're doing, see everything that they are talking about on this show visually, and all their examples, all their slides, all their pictures that they even draw. Everything is on there. Go to successfullyunemployed.co/YouTube. Or if you just go to YouTube and type in Successfully Unemployed, more than likely you're going to find me. So successfullyunemployed.co/YouTube. And I would truly appreciate it if you subscribe to Successfully Unemployed on YouTube and wherever you're listening to this podcast, subscribe to this show so that you can always get every bit of new information on how to quit your J-O-B. Also, if you got anything out of the show, share it with just one person. Share it with just one person so that they can see the light, that it is so much better to not work a job, be successfully unemployed, and be your own boss. All right, guys, this is it for today's show. I will see you next week. See ya.